in the United States, and we're not going to talk about any politics tonight. Anybody who starts politics will get a glass of tea thrown at them. So before I introduce our speaker, I'd like to just a few little house taken care of. I'm David Alkak. I'm the president of the Dallas Philosophers Forum. Welcome, by the way, to the forum. This is a going concern that's been going on for about 45 years here in Dallas. We have all kinds of talks, not just about philosophy, but we have science and some
history.
Politics.
History. Sometimes history.
And what?
I said sometimes history.
Yes, all kinds of things. Art. We had the Poet Laureate of Oklahoma. And somebody said, I didn't know they had poetry in Oklahoma. But yes. So we collect $5 a person. And if you're a student, a full-time student, it's $2 because philosophy is not free. We do things with our money, give it away, and scholarships, etc. Are there any newcomers that haven't been here before? Hey, how did you find out about us?
Great.
Anybody else?
Google. Yep.
Google? All right.
All my friends come here.
Make sure that you, if you've ordered some food or drink tonight, to pay your bill. We don't want to be stuck with it. That's not part of our budget. Take care of your server, of course. So now I'm going to introduce our speaker, Dr. Sloan Lee, who was actually born in Midland, Texas. Good old Texas boy. Raised in Plano. Moved there with your parents when you were about three. Went to University of North Texas, undergraduate, and then his master's and PhD at Wayne State in Detroit. His dissertation focused on the philosophy of religion, specifically an analysis of various arguments against rational belief in the miraculous. His expertise includes the philosophy of religion. Right now, he is training in data analysis, kind of a shift of paradigm, sort of, from philosophy. But he says that his philosophy background is kind of helping him in computer and data analysis. He's married and has a 11-year-old daughter who's in the back there. He enjoys science fiction and fantasy and literature and film, and is an avid gamer. So without any further ado, welcome Dr. Sloan Lee.
Hi, I'd like to begin by thanking Ken and the others for inviting me back. I remember my last visit here was really enjoyable for me, and the discussion afterwards was very spirited, and I enjoyed that. And it's I also want to thank you for coming out on the election night. It's very humbling for that you would forego election parties to come hear philosophy. I, for one, would do that any time. But I appreciate the time that you're sharing with me. I have copies of my paper to distribute. I don't think I made enough of them. So if you would like to forego having the paper and just listen to the presentation, you could just pass them on. And if I could get some assistance just sort of passing them around, here's about half of them, and I'll pass these around this way.
Thank you.
All right, so, Brighton? Brighton? Brighton, you're humming and it's making it hard for me to think. All right, so, so this is my daughter Brighton. She's come out to not pay attention to me. I think that's pretty good advice. So, tonight I'd like to speak about the scale of the universe and what bearing that may or may not have on one's belief in whether or not God exists. And there's a couple of quotes at the beginning of the paper, and I'll just go through those and reference them in the paper. Stephen Hawking said in 1979 that the size and age of the cosmos are beyond ordinary human understanding. And Boethius, in his book, The Constellation of Philosophy, in the early 6th century, said, "It is well known, and you have seen it demonstrated by the astronomers, that besides the extent of the heavens, the circumference of the earth has the size of a point. That is to say, compared with the magnitude of the celestial sphere, it may be thought of as having no extent at all." Carl Sagan, in his companion book to the 14-part PBS television series Cosmos, writes that we float in the cosmos like a mote of dust in the morning sky. He then adds, "The size and age of the cosmos are beyond ordinary human understanding. Lost somewhere between immensity and eternity is our tiny planetary home." Sagan vividly continues his portrayal of the immensity of the universe. "The dimensions of the cosmos are so large that using familiar units of distance, such as meters or miles, makes little sense. The Earth is a place. It is by no means the only place. It is not even a typical place. No planet or star or galaxy can be typical because the cosmos is mostly empty. The only typical place is within the vast, cold, universal vacuum, the everlasting night of intergalactic space, a place so strange and desolate that by comparison, planets and stars and galaxies seem achingly rare and lovely. If we were randomly inserted into the cosmos, the chance that we would find ourselves on or near a planet would be less than one in a billion, trillion, trillion." Yet Sagan is not the only astronomer to comment on the scale of the universe. In 1979, the year before Cosmos aired on public television stations in the United States, Stephen Hawking delivered his inaugural lecture upon being awarded the position of the Lucasian Professor of Mathematics at the University of Cambridge. During the lecture, he took some time to reflect upon the anthropic principle, which he describes with some inaccuracy as the principle that the universe is the way it is because of us. He says that there are reasons to find this principle to be unsatisfactory. For example, our solar system is certainly a prerequisite for our existence, as is an earlier generation of nearby stars in which heavy elements could have been formed by nuclear synthesis. It might even be that the whole of our galaxy was required. But there does not seem to be any necessity for other galaxies to exist, let alone the million, million or so of them that we see distributed roughly uniformly throughout the observable universe. This large-scale homogeneity of the universe makes it very difficult to believe that the structure of the universe is determined by anything so peripheral as some complicated molecular structures on a minor planet orbiting a very average star in the outer suburbs of a fairly typical spiral galaxy. Of course, the sheer size of the universe hardly counts as new knowledge, as the quote from Boethius above just demonstrates. What is new, however, is our ability to quantify in some rough and general way the size of the observable universe in relation to the size of the Earth. That is one, I think, of the great accomplishments of modern astronomy, along with many other very impressive achievements. Also new is the fact that some have attempted to take the size of the universe to be evidence against the existence of God. In particular, Nicholas Everett, who teaches philosophy at the University of East Anglia, presents an argument against the existence of God in his aptly named book, The Non-Existence of God. In his book, Everett offers a broad survey of perennial problems in the philosophy of religion from the position of a non-theist. The book addresses topics ranging from the concept of God and natural theology to the role of reason in the philosophy of religion and arguments against the existence of God. The fact that Everett dedicates a chapter of his book to advancing the argument from scale distinguishes it from other works of atheists and non-theists in the philosophy of religion. Generally, Everett's argument from scale seeks to show that the probability of God's existence is lowered by the evidence drawn from the size of the universe, the age of the universe, and the fact that much of the universe is inhospitable to life. However, there are reasons to think that Everett's argument from scale does not succeed in showing that the probability of theism is lower given such evidence. So what is the argument? How can it be precisely formulated? In the text, Everett says that his argument aims to show that the picture of the universe with which modern science presents us constitutes evidence against the truth of theism. And he adds on the next page that the nature of the universe revealed by modern science gives us reasons to reject traditional theism. To quote the text precisely, Everett gives this formal presentation of the argument. Premise 1. If the God of classical theism existed with the purposes it traditionally ascribed to God, then God would create the universe on a human scale. That is, one that is not unimaginably large, unimaginably old, and which human beings form an unimaginably tiny part of it, temporally and spatially. Premise 2. The world does not display a human scale. Therefore, the conclusion in 3, there is evidence against the hypothesis that the God of classical theism exists with the purposes traditionally ascribed to God from premises 1 and 2. This argument, being a straightforward instance of modus tollens, which is just the inference form, if P, then Q, not Q, therefore not P, is clearly deductively valid. So that if the premises of this argument are true, then we will be constrained to accept the conclusion of this argument, whether you like it or not. It seems pretty clear that the universe does not display a human scale, and that Everett's use of the term world doesn't refer to our planet, but to the universe as a whole, or at least the observable universe. So the second premise of the argument seems, I think, entirely unobjectionable. But what are we to make of the first premise? The premise is not exactly clear on its own. What are the purposes traditionally ascribed to God? And how are those purposes relevant to the scale of the universe, both its age and size? Fortunately for the reader, the material he presents prior to his statement of the argument makes his meaning relatively clear. And I have to say, this is one of the things I really like about Everett's book. He goes quite some distance in making his thought plain. And sometimes that's something philosophers don't achieve. According to Everett, traditional theism, or classical theism, presents us with a particular account of God's purposes and properties. And he writes, and I have a long quote here, and he says, Consider first the account of God's nature and purposes with which theism presents us. Theism tells us that God is a being who is omnipotent and omniscient, wholly self-sufficient, with no needs, lacks, or deficiencies of any kind. God decides to create a universe in which human beings will be the jewel. Although he will have care for the whole of creation, God will have a special care for human beings, because humans are the jewel of creation. The rest of the universe will be at least not unremittingly hostile or even indifferent to human flourishing. Even if the universe will not make such flourishing immediately and easily and painlessly accessible, it will make it at least accessible in principle for humanity at large. End quote. He follows this with the claim that such a description would naturally lead us to find a universe of a particular kind. Specifically, Everett thinks that this should lead one to expect to find a universe created on a human scale. By human scale, Everett has the following in mind. He says, in particular, traditional theism would lead you to expect human beings to appear fairly soon after the start of the universe. For given the central role of humanity, what would be the point of a universe which came into existence and then existed for unimaginable eons without the presence of the very species that supplied its rationale? But equally, you would not expect humans to arrive very long after the animals. For what would be the point of a universe existing for eons full of animals created for humanity's delectation in the absence of any humans? Further, you would expect the Earth to be fairly near the center of the universe if it had one, or at some similarly significant location if it did not have an actual center. You would expect the total universe not to be many orders of magnitude greater than the size of the Earth. The universe would be on a human scale. You would expect that even if there are regions of the created world which are hostile to human life and which perhaps are incompatible with it, the greater part of the universe would be accessible to human exploration. End quote. Now that we have seen whatever it means by human scale and by traditional or classical theism, we can see that the formulation that Everett gives to his argument is incomplete. Given that by traditional theism or classical theism, Everett means a theism in which humans are the most important thing in the universe, perhaps following God, we can give a complete statement of Everett's argument as follows. The first premise, if the God of traditional theism exists, then God created humans to be the most important thing in the universe. The second premise, if God created humans to be the most important thing in the universe, then God would create a universe on a human scale, that is, one that is not unimaginably large, unimaginably old, and which human beings form, and in which humans form an unimaginably tiny part of it, temporally and spatially. Third premise, the universe does not display this sort of human scale. Therefore, seven, the God of traditional theism does not exist. That this really is the argument that Everett intended is made plain by his use of the phrase, the jewel of creation, in reference to humanity. With an accurate statement of Everett's argument in hand, we have to ask ourselves two questions. First, does traditional theism entail that God created humans to be the most important thing in the universe? In other words, is that premise of the argument true? Second, and the second question we want to ask, even assuming that God created humans to be the most important thing in the universe, or among the most important things in the universe, would it follow that the universe needs to be on a human scale? In short, is that premise of the argument true? In what follows, it will become clear that the answer to both of these questions turns out to be no. does traditional theism entail the primacy of humanity? That is the first aspect of this argument that I want to examine. In discussing traditional theism, it becomes rather clear that Everett really has in mind something like Christian theism, or maybe what we can call biblical theism, that is, theism that is in some way based on the Bible. For instance, Everett writes, "These expectations are largely what we find in the Genesis story, or strictly stories of creation," since there's two creation stories, one in Genesis 1 and another in Genesis 2. There is then a logic to the picture of the universe in which the Genesis story presents us, given the initial assumptions about God, God's nature, and God's intentions. The Genesis universe is pretty much how it would be reasonable for God to proceed. Given the hypothesis of theism and no scientific knowledge at all, we then and then asked to construct a picture of the universe and its creation, it is not surprising that the authors of Genesis came up with the account which they did. Moreover, as we have already seen, Everett seems to think that an essential element of Christian theism, or what we might call biblical theism, is the view that humans are the most important element in God's creation. As he says, humans are the jewel of creation. However, this issue bears further reflection. Nowhere in the accounts of creation in Genesis, whether taken in a literalistic fashion or whether taken interpreted as conveying truths through symbols and images, does the text ever say that humans are the jewel of creation, or that humans are the most valuable things in all the created order. One simply finds the text lacking in any such pronouncements. Everett appears to be inserting claims into the text that are not there. Given this, there is no reason to think that premise 4 of his revised argument is true. There is no reason then to think that biblical theism holds that humans occupy a place of primacy. However, one might respond to the fact that the text does not clearly state the claim of the superlative importance of humanity's place in the created order by saying that the text strongly suggests that humans are the most important thing in creation. After all, doesn't the text say that humans are created in God's own image? And doesn't the text say that the creation of humanity was very good? The argument then could be extended as follows. Premise 8, according to Genesis, humans are created in God's image. Premise 9, according to Genesis, God calls the creation of humans very good. Premise 10, if according to Genesis, humans are created in God's image, and God calls the creation of humans very good, then humans are the most important thing in all of creation. That is, humans are the jewel of creation. Therefore, 11, according to Genesis, humans are the most important thing in all of creation, and humans are the jewel of creation. So in this way, we can say that this is a supporting argument for premise 4 of his argument from Scale. Now, it is true that the Genesis text, whether interpreted literally or symbolically, claims that humans are made in the image of God. See Genesis 1:27 for that claim. However, premise 9 of this supporting argument turns out to be false. According to Genesis, God does not simply call the creation of humanity very good. Rather, the text states, "And God saw everything that God had made, and behold, it was very good." Genesis 1:31. So, if the conclusion is to be reached, then it must be reached on the force of premises 8 and 10 alone, without premise 9. But can these premises bear the dialectical weight placed on them? It seems to me that the answer to that is no. First, there is no reason to think, based on the text alone, that humans are the only creatures in all of creation that are created in God's image. or that God's creation is limited merely to what is described in the first two chapters of Genesis. At no point in the text is it stated that the accounts given there are exhaustive of God's creative activity, if there is a God, and if God engages in that sort of activity. At least the text doesn't entail it. Second, even if humans are the only beings in all of creation with the feature of being created in the image of God, being created in God's image may imply something other than primacy of place. For example, being created in God's image may merely imply that human beings are not morally and spiritually neutral, rather than implying that humans have the first positions in the pecking order of importance. In fact, the Apostle Paul, who certainly had some familiarity with these passages from Genesis, instructively points out that it is not only humans that are being reconciled to God by the work of Jesus. Rather, Paul writes, God has reconciled all things in heaven and earth to himself through the blood of Jesus' cross. Colossians 1:28. In short, it is consistent to maintain both that humans are created in the image of God and that humans are not the most important element of God's creation. There's no contradiction in saying both of these things, whether or not anything in the text is actually true or false. Again, it is consistent with traditional theism to say both that humans are created in the image of God and that humans are not the most important thing in the material universe. So, given the traditional Christian view, whatever that amounts to, does an appeal to the Christian scriptures support the claim that humans must be the most important element of God's creation? Given what's been said, the answer to this question is rather clearly appears to be no. Even if, unknown to us, it happens to be true that humans are the most important objects of creation, the texts appealed to by Everett simply do not give us any reason for claiming such a thing to be true or essential to Christian theism or Christian doctrine. Of course, the idea that humans are not the most important part of or the most important element of creation has been held by some Christians. Consider, for example, the words of Thomas Chalmers penned in 1855. So this view has been around a while. This argument involves in it an assertion and an inference. The assertion is that Christianity is a religion which professes to be designed for the single benefit of our world. And the inference is that God cannot be the author of this religion, for he would not lavish on so insignificant a field such peculiar and such distinguished attentions as are ascribed to him in the Old and New Testament. Christianity makes no such profession. That it is designed for the single benefit of our world is altogether a presumption of the infidel, end quote. In other words, the idea that Christianity must teach, or even usually teaches, the primacy of humans as one of its essential and historical doctrines is nothing more than a figment in the imagination of skeptics like Everett and company. The upshot, then, is that Everett has engaged in a rather unconvincing use of the straw man fallacy, that is, giving an implausible account of something when there are more plausible accounts of that position available, whether or not those positions actually happen to be true or false. What has been pointed out thus far is alone sufficient to completely bulldoze Everett's argument. But more can be said about the other premises. And why stop kicking an argument when it's already down? I guess I have that vicious philosophical streak in me, so why not? So let us look at the other premise in question. Does traditional theism entail a universe built on a human scale? Hawking is wrong to say, as per the quote at the beginning of the essay, that the size of the universe is beyond ordinary human understanding. It may be beyond our ability to imagine, and I think it is, but it certainly is not beyond our ability to quantitatively comprehend and understand in broad terms, given that we, in fact, possess a general understanding of the quantitative scale of the observable universe, since understanding is not coextensive with the faculty of imagination. So what I'm saying there is that while we can't imagine the scale of the universe, I think that is beyond a typical human imagination, beyond universal human imagination, that is not coextensive with understanding that scale in general terms. Hawking is just mistaken in saying otherwise, and it is this sort of confusion that philosophers can help us to avoid. Further, it is not surprising to find Hawking falling into this sort of confusion given his recent denigration of philosophy when he makes the self-defeating declaration that philosophy is dead in his book, The Grand Design. It is a self-defeating declaration, obviously, because it is a philosophical claim that is being made by Hawking. Every bit as self-defeating as when one says, this sentence contains no letters. Moreover, the fact that we have some understanding of the scale of the universe is clearly illustrated by a few passages from Everett's book, where he describes at some length the enormous scale of the universe. We will begin by looking at his comments concerning the size of the universe. And I quote him, "The sun is about 8 light minutes from us. The next nearest star is about 4.3 light years," which is amazing. "The next nearest galaxy to the Milky Way is scores of light years away. Current findings indicate that the furthest star visible from the Earth is about 3 billion light years away." In other words, the most distant visible star is very roughly some 200,000 trillion times as far away as the sun. This sort of scale is to the universe makes no conceivable sense on the theistic hypothesis, end quote. Everett adds, assuming that the expansion of the universe was at least less than the speed of light, the overall size of the universe is between 10 and 30 billion light years across, and asks, why would God make it that big? But what would be the point of the superabundance of celestial matter, especially given the fact that the very great majority of humanity will never be aware of most of it? End quote. However, it is not clear, at least not to me, why the vast majority of humanity will or must remain unaware of the fact that there is a superabundance of celestial matter, even if that is currently the case. Unless, perhaps, Everett thinks that the human race is soon coming to an end, or that the future of the human race will remain educationally impoverished. It is not clear why he thinks that this is the case, and let us hope that he is wrong about that. If the human race persists for a sufficiently long period of time, and if education becomes sufficiently widespread, then most humans will become aware of the great abundance of celestial matter, given enough time. Nevertheless, there are interesting questions in the vicinity. Why is the universe so unimaginably large? Why are there vast empty distances between stars, and even vaster, emptier distances between galaxies? In considering these sorts of questions, one has to keep in mind a few other questions before trying to answer them. What reason is there to think that we would need to know or could even understand the answers to such questions if there were a God? Maybe there is no God, but if there were a God and God could communicate those answers to us, what grounds do we think that we would have for understanding them? I think that's an important question. There is some reason for thinking that the answers to these particular questions might be beyond our ken, namely because we're not divine minds. Yet, even if we were capable of understanding the answers to these particular questions, what pressing need is there for us to know their answers? Will knowing why the universe is between 10 and 30 billion light years across invariably produce good fathers and honest politicians? It does not seem so. Would knowledge of the vast age of the universe promote the welfare of orphans and widows? It is not clear that it would. Perhaps Everett is merely asking the theist to speculate or generate a few hypotheses in response to these questions. Well, that is easy enough, but it will have to wait until the concluding section of this paper. Nevertheless, and more importantly, even if humans are the most important thing in creation, and I'm not saying they are, and in fact I don't even have any good reason to think that they are, there are still no grounds stemming from the supposition alone, from that supposition alone, that would entail that there are no good reasons for creating an unimaginably large universe. Reasons which have nothing at all to do with humans. The only way that Everett could reach that conclusion is to say not only that humans are the most important object of God's creation, but that nothing else in creation other than humanity is of any importance at all to God. Putting Everett's unstated assumption in other terms, we get, if the God of traditional theism exists, then nothing but humans have value. But why think that? Everett is entirely silent on why we should think that this unstated assumption is true. Without that assumption, we have no reason to suppose that creating an unimaginably immense universe is problematic in the least. Everett gives us no reason at all for thinking that the only things of any value in the universe are humans. In fact, most traditional theists would deny Everett's assumption. And some theists might even appeal to biblical texts on that point in order to deny Everett's assumption that the universe accepting humans is without value, especially given the statement of Genesis 1:31 that all of creation is very good. In short, Everett seems to be mistaken about what is implied by the text he is appealing to, even granting the unfounded or unsupported claim that humans are the most important thing in the universe. Next, we turn to his comments about the vast age of the universe and the vast age of the earth. And he says, our best estimates are that the universe itself is roughly 15 billion years old, and I understand that since the publication of this text a couple years back, these numbers have been revised slightly. And that the Earth is about 5 billion years old. How long ago humans have existed will depend partly, he says, on what we take humans to be. And he continues, but if we take humans to be Homo sapiens, and if we take them to be creatures with some sort of language and some sort of social culture, then realistic estimates which allow that they have existed for no more than 100,000 years. So if we imagine the history of the universe represented by a line which is roughly 24 miles long, human life would occupy only the last inch. End quote. The point here is that for something more than 99.999% of the history of the universe, the creatures which are meant to be the jewel of creation have been absent from it. This, Everett thinks, is unfitting. Again, as already demonstrated, we have no reason to suppose that traditional theism entails that humans are the most important thing in the universe or that they're the jewel of creation, nor do we have any reason to think that anything found in the Christian scriptures entail that humans are the most important thing in the universe. But contrary to all of this, let us suppose the traditional theism or that some type of reading of Genesis entails that humans are the most important thing in the universe. Would that supposition give Everett his desired conclusion when combined with the age of the universe? It is hard to see why it would. If all of creation is very good, then why would mere human absence for the vast majority of that history diminish that intrinsic goodness? Everett doesn't say. So again, we see Everett's unstated assumption operating in the background as the true engine that is driving his argument. Namely, that the only thing that has any value at all in the universe is humanity and nothing else. As should be obvious by now, such a claim is an implausible and entirely unsupported assumption that would be rejected by the vast majority of traditional theists, if not by all Christian theists. And Everett says nothing in its favor. In other words, even if premise four of his argument were true, that is, even if it were true that God created humans to be the most important thing in the universe, premise five of the argument remains false, because even if humans are the most important thing, are more important than anything else in the universe, despite our having no theological or philosophical reason for thinking this, it still would not follow that humans were the only important thing in the universe. Thus, there would be no need to think that this entails that the universe needs to be created on a human scale, either in terms of its size or in terms of its age. As an additional aside, Everett seems to believe, with respect to the age of the universe, that humans will only last a short while. If humans persist for eons to come, then this will, as a matter of empirical fact, invalidate his appeal to the age of the universe. Of course, nothing in the previous response to his argument hinges on this. In any case, Everett's argument is terrifically implausible, given that two of its crucial premises are undeniably false. And now we come to some concluding speculations. Despite the fact that Everett's argument has been shown to be entirely implausible and lacking in evidential merit, at least on its interpretive issues, we can here venture forth a few conjectures as to why the universe might be so large in size on the hypothesis of theism. However, one must keep in mind that even if everything that follows turns out to be wrong, just straightforwardly false, in fact, that will have no impact on the prior critique of Everett's fallacious argument that I've already given. That argument has already been demonstrated to be faulty, and what follows is merely exploratory speculation. On the issue of intercultural contact, one does not have to go too far back in history to find examples of such contact going horribly wrong. Not that such contact always goes wrong, but examples of potential pitfalls and opportunities for abuse and exploitation are numerous and easy to come by. Moreover, this is the case in which humans are dealing with other humans. How much more dangerous and potentially disastrous might be the complexities of extraterrestrial cultural exchange and contact? In the case of mere terrestrial cultural conflict, even within a single culture, the stakes can be high and the conflicts can be bitter, acrimonious, and sometimes violent. For instance, think of the acrimony and violence that has been spurred on by the conflict over abortion just in contemporary North America. Moreover, reflect upon the result of cultural entanglements when Cortez decided to visit Mexico. A first-person account of the ensuing death, destruction, and violence is vividly portrayed by Bernal Diaz del Castillo in his memoirs, The Conquest of New Spain, which chronicles the blood-achieved ambitions of Cortez at the expense of the brutal cannibal inhabitants of the New World. Think again of the Vikings and their bloody and eventful interactions with the cultures of England and Western Europe in the 900s AD. There is a long and detailed record of cultural exchange embodied in human history, and more often than not, while there are a few bright exceptions, it seems that things do not turn out well. The potential for intercultural disaster on an interstellar scale is explored imaginatively in the science fiction book The Sparrow. In that book, radio waves are intercepted. They indicate the presence of intelligent extraterrestrial life orbiting a nearby star. In response, the United Nations begins a multi-year debate on what to do about it. But the Vatican immediately commences their own space program and launches a bunch of Jesuits into space in order to make first contact. The book begins with the return of their spaceship to Earth, while the UN is still debating. There is one remaining Jesuit left on board. He is prone to violence and will not speak to others, and all of his fingers have been elongated, leaving him essentially handicapped. The imagination of the reader can determine how that bit of cultural exchange went down, and whether or not it was an agreeable process. The story brings to mind the words of Stephen Hawking. And he says, "We only have to look at ourselves to see how intelligent life might develop into something we wouldn't want to meet. I imagine that they might exist in massive ships, having used up all the resources from their home planet. Such advanced aliens would perhaps become nomads, looking to conquer and colonize whatever planets they can reach. If aliens ever visit us, I think the outcome would be much as when Christopher Columbus first landed in America, which didn't turn out very well for the Native Americans." End quote. In short, given our inductive evidence drawn from human history, the idea of pursuing intercultural contact with alien intelligence, if there be any, might not be such a grand idea. Let us suppose that, in fact, it is a terrible idea. Suppose that the universe is, in fact, teeming with intelligent life. Further suppose, as we have been considering, that intercultural exchange with an alien race might not be altogether splendid, but rather something likely to be dreadful. Now, we have a perfectly good hypothetical explanation at hand for the unimaginably vast size and age of our universe. Supposing that there is only one intelligent civilization per galaxy, or perhaps the number is slightly less than this, say, one intelligent civilization per every two galaxies. The odds of any two of these civilizations being near one another is quite remote. This, it may turn out, is a very great mercy, especially given what we know about the very poor intercultural interactions among humans within the history of our own species. One might even find the idea that one would have to cross the inconceivably vast distances between galaxies to reach the next nearest technologically advanced alien race to be downright comforting. For those who are more optimistic about the potential benevolence of intergalactic alien races, if there are any such races, one might carefully consider the words from the essay, "Why I Am Not a Christian," by the atheist philosopher Bertrand Russell. And he says, "In the part of this universe that we know, there is great injustice. And often the good suffer and the wicked prosper, and it is And one hardly knows which of those two is more annoying. If you looked into the matter from a scientific point of view, you would say, after all, I only know this world, and I do not know about the rest of the universe. But so far as one can argue at all on probabilities, one would say that probably this world is a fair sample. And if there is injustice here, the odds are that there is injustice elsewhere also. Thank you very much.
Okay, we're going to introduce some questions for Dr. Lee. And try to keep your questions as questions kind of short. Don't get into a long harangue. We want to get a home for the festivities or whatever it is. I'm going to, you know, cut it off probably at 9:15 so we can get home. So, all right. Any questions? Yes.
I'll speak up. It seems like your argument, or your argument with the premise, means that God must be the Einstein God, the deist God, one that doesn't pay much attention to humanity. Am I reading you right?
The argument that I've been making, or the line of thought that I've been pursuing in the paper, is perfectly consistent with being an atheist, right? What one asks, one just asks counterfactually, if there were a God of the sort that Everett is talking about, what would follow from that, right? It doesn't follow from that, though, that the type of God counterfactually imagined would have to be a deistic God. That God might very well be involved in all of, to draw from the speculation at the end of my paper, might be involved in all of those intelligences maybe at some point or other throughout the universe in a non-deistic fashion. Although it would be consistent with the deistic interpretation of theism as well.
Come on, this is a subject.
You spoke against city premises and didn't find those valid and for which I agree. Are there any premises that you would make if you were going to write that book yourself that you would find to be valid premises?
Let me make sure I understand the question correctly. So you're asking if I were writing a book on atheism, what sorts of premises would I appeal to in the attempt to justify the atheist outlook? I think the most powerful argument against the existence of God is the argument from or based on suffering. I think that is the most difficult challenge the theist faces. I think that was well articulated by David Hume in his book, The Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion, in chapters 9 and 10, or Dialogues 9 and 10. And then a very powerful statement of the problem of evil was again articulated by the philosopher J.L. Mackey in the early 1980s in his book, The Miracle of Theism. And most recently, the most powerful statement of the argument from suffering was made by William Rowe. It's called The Problem of Suffering and Some Varieties of Atheism. And it is the single most powerful argument for atheism that I've ever read. However, being a theist, I'm not ultimately convinced by that argument. Right? I think that argument, there are certain considerations which counterbalance that argument. They don't completely mitigate the persuasive force of the argument, but I think that they reduce the effectiveness of William Rowe's argument from suffering. And then I think that argument is then can be put on the scale, as it were, against arguments for atheism, and then you just have to weigh out what you think is more probable, given the problem of suffering weighed against arguments for theism. And so, if I was to argue for the atheist position, I would go immediately to the problem of suffering. So I think I understood your question. Did I understand your question? Okay. Yes.
So the argument that you've been refuting seems almost the polar opposite of the cosmological argument, which, because I've heard the argument made that from the size and age of the immensity of the universe, you could actually infer the postulate of an intelligence necessary to produce, such an entity. So I'm just, my question is, what do you think of the cosmological argument?
Right. I have something of a love-hate relationship with the cosmological argument. I think the most plausible version of the cosmological argument that I've run across is formulated by Robert Coons, who teaches philosophy at the University of Texas at Austin. It's an article that's available online. It's called A New Look at the Cosmological Argument. However, it's a rather technical paper. My problem with, say, Thomas Aquinas' version of the cosmological argument isn't so much that I think it's wrong, is that I'm not convinced that I understand it. Okay? But there are other arguments that I do find persuasive for theism. And in particular, I'm very keen on Anselm's version in the Proslogion, Chapter 2 of the Ontological Argument. And I find the standard textbook criticisms of that particular argument to be fallacious. I didn't always think so, but I remember when I revisited that argument with the assumption that Guanillo had debunked it. When I revisited it, I realized that Guanillo's objection actually doesn't hit the mark. And that's, of course, another paper. Maybe I'll come back and present on that at some point. But that's another issue. But there are other arguments that I think that are compelling for theism, that being one of them.
Okay. I don't have my copy of the Book of Genesis along with me.
Oh, fair enough.
But
me neither.
In your arguing against what's his name's
Nicholas Everett.
Everett's mm-hmm. argument. Mm-hmm. You're trying to say that in the biblical account there is no placing of mankind in a special position.
Mm-hmm. Not that I could find. A position of primacy, I should say.
But there is a text that talks about the humankind being given dominion over creation.
Okay.
And that is, to me, is one of the central points of the whole story of creation in the Bible.
Well,
and I find it kind of strange that you ignore that particular text.
Actually, I didn't ignore it. I mean, I'm familiar with the text you're referring to, and I did give quite a bit of thought about the issue of dominion. As far as I could tell, the dominion is over the birds, the plants, but it's not clear to me from the text that the dominion is over all of the universe, right? So it's not clear to me, and so when we talk about that text and how to read it, and when we talk about in particular the question of dominion, it's clear to me that the text entails that humans would have dominion over plants and animals on Earth. But that's as far as I can see that the text specifically entails. Now, maybe I'm wrong about that, and if I'm wrong about that, then I would revise my conclusions in my paper here. So I'm open to hearing more about that and how maybe an argument, an interpretive way to interpret that text could extend the notion of dominion to imply all of the universe, right?
Well, that's one Holy Scripture. I mean, there's lots of Holy Scripture.
Well, I'm interested.
Lots of creation stories.
Fair enough. But Nicholas Everett didn't appeal to those. Okay. He appealed in particular to the biblical theism. I didn't even want to talk about the Bible.
No.
Nicholas Everett is the one who drug it into the room and started panting around, and I was like, whatever, okay, I'll talk about it. He really wants me to. Sure.
It seems like the question is, what is, does the word God mean? What do you mean by the word God?
Right.
I don't have an answer yet.
Oh, okay.
For example, you know, if we use the concept of pantheism or panentheism, mm-hmm. then that concept of God, that involves the whole of creation, the whole of the cosmos, then it doesn't matter how big or how old the cosmos is. If God is it plus its essence, mm-hmm. and as Stephen Hawking said, we don't need an answer of a transcendent God or being to explain the creation of the universe scientifically. But, you know, scientifically, it's probably unlikely that there is a God. But philosophically, it's still possible. You can't prove it or disprove it. So I think, you know, just because the universe is huge or very, very old, doesn't prove or disprove, you know, the existence of God. What do you think of that?
There are a lot of issues going on in what you just said. And let me just parse some of them out. When talking about proof or disproof, proof or disproof for much of anything is very difficult to come by. As Bishop Butler once said, probability is the guide to life. And so I think that rational evaluation of theism and atheism should proceed along the lines of what is likely, given the evidences that we have available to us, rather than proof or disproof. Specifically, one can't, and you'll balk at this, but I don't care. You can't prove, at least nobody has yet, to my satisfaction, prove to me that there's a lectern in front of me. That there's a lectern in front of me. I believe there's a lectern in front of me. Why wouldn't I? All the evidence seems to suggest that there is a lectern in front of me. But proof in a mathematical sense is just simply not available for something like that. Not that I've been able to find, and I've searched. And maybe my views are open to revision on that. If you could find a proof of a mathematical variety, of a deductive variety, that there are physical objects around us in this way, then, right? If I can't prove that there's a lectern in front of me, well, then how could anyone be expected to prove, right, apodeptically, like beyond the possibility of rational doubt, that a God doesn't exist or God does exist? However, having said that, rationality is not completely impotent at that point, right? It can still make assessments based on available evidence. Now, if one says, well, what kind of scientific argument is there for the existence of God? Well, that's the next thing, plank, I want to parse out of that. What do we mean by a scientific argument, right? Can God be the conclusion of, say, a scientific demonstration? I think not. However, are there results stemming from the sciences that philosophers might employ towards reasoning about the existence or non-existence of God? And I think the answer to that is yes. Are those scientific arguments? No. They're philosophical arguments that employ the results of science. So there may be scientific arguments in some broad sense of that term, right? And Everett, and I appreciate this fact about Everett's book, is that he's trying to take some of the results of science and then employ them in a philosophical argument in an attempt to provide us an argument against the existence of God, showing us that the existence of God is unlikely. I'm just not convinced by the argument, but this paper was to show why. There's more to be said on that, but I think I've said enough to sort of show my general line of thought on those sorts of issues. Yes?
Yes, yeah, I agree with you that you can't prove that the assertion God exists is true, and you can't prove it's not true. It's, in scientific terms, it would be regarded as an unfalsifiable statement. Also, it seems that it's up to the people who make the assertion that God exists to provide evidence for it. It's not a requirement for people who are skeptical about that to prove that God doesn't exist. The onus is on the people that make that assertion to prove it. Now, from the perspective of the 21st century, I think we can look back and see why people 3,000 years ago asserted that there was a God who was a person who made humans in his image. But there's another assertion we could make now, and that is that humans created God in their image. So what would be your argument against that, or is there any argument that is relevant?
Right. What I would say with respect to those, I want to make 2 points here. The first point that I want to make is that, okay, so while there might not be, scientific proof for or against the existence of God, I think that, I'm going to say, well, this will be wildly unpopular, but I'll say it anyway. I don't think there are scientific proofs for or against anything ever. I don't think science is the kind of thing that is capable of providing proofs. I think that science is being a generally inductive enterprise, all right, it can provide us with reasons to believe, which are less than deductive proofs or demonstrations.
Right.
So when I say, when you say that there's no scientific proof for the existence of God, I would say, well, yeah, and because there are no scientific proofs for anything ever. There are scientific evidences, right? And one wants to follow the best evidence that one has insofar as one is capable of doing so. At least that, so I actually agree with David Hume on that point when he says that the wise person proportions their beliefs to the evidence. The second point I want to make with respect to what you just said is that I think that I agree with Hume on that point, that you should proportion your belief insofar as possible to the evidence. And in fact, my theism is not, say, a matter of religious experience, because, well, I don't have religious experience, and people talk about it, and it sounds nice, but I don't know what that is. And the second thing, secondly, my theism, then, I take it to be based on arguments, right, that are ones that are arguments of probability, following the evidence as best I'm capable. I think the arguments for theism are better than the arguments against theism. And I know that there are people who rationally disagree with me on that point, and I'm fine with that, and that's part of what I enjoy about the philosophy of religion, is going through those arguments. But to the best of my lights, right, to the best of my understanding of those arguments, I think the arguments for theism are pretty good. Not all of them. I think some of them are terrible. I think Pascal's wager is terribly unconvincing.
Could you define the theism that you find plausible?
Oh, it's just sort of very generic, actually. In fact, the very lines that Everett put forward of being that and he says omniscient, but I would say superlatively knowing. He says omnibenevolent, but I would say superlatively good. I would alter the language a little bit, but along those lines, a God that is all-knowing, omnibenevolent, omnipresent, and so on. Right? It's not. I don't hold to a theistic conception of God. I hold to what might be described as generally. Well, I mentioned earlier the ontological argument when responding to somebody else, I don't remember who now, and there are other arguments in addition to that, and I'm more than happy to come back and present a paper on the particular arguments that I find persuasive and why I think that the objections against them that are traditionally levied against them don't work, and in particular the ontological argument. I've been through, again, I'll say it again, through all the standard textbook objections to the ontological argument, all of which that I thought were good at one point, I now find them, all of them, fantastically unpersuasive or question-begging. And so I find the ontological argument ultimately very compelling towards the theistic position. Having said that, I have certain concerns about the Platonic premise of that argument. But again, that doesn't mean anything to most people, given that I haven't laid out those premises just yet. So,
is there any other questions?
Yes.
This may sound far-fetched, but do you think...
No more far-fetched than me.
Well, I wonder if this author, I haven't read this book, but I wonder if this author Everett, do you wonder if maybe his point was rather to ask about the primacy of humans amongst other life forms in the universe? It just seems that this argument that he presented was so clumsy just from the beginning, not only for the points that you mentioned, but it seems like when it boils down to it, what he's asking is, why do things exist that we can't perceive of, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, if you think about somebody like Democritus, right, the Greek philosopher who thought about atoms first. Before, that was a dream. Nobody thought there were smaller things that the whole universe consisted of. But we found it, what we later perceived of these things, we found out what they were. I wonder if maybe his point was to bring up this question of primacy.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of it being about, like I said, the argument to me just doesn't seem convincing at all. It seems like pretty obvious straw just from the beginning. So I just thought maybe there was...
I've really bent over backwards to try to not give a straw man presentation of his argument. And in fact, I've worked overtime to try to present his argument in the most charitable light that I've available to me. And Everett really does take his argument to be evidence against theism. And I will say this in Everett's favor. A good philosopher is, and a good writer even, is one who writes with a certain sort of clarity, right? Such that even his faults become clear or evident, right? And if I can write in that way so that the faults in my own thinking can become evident, then other people can point those faults out to me, and I'd benefit as a result. And actually, this is one of the things I actually appreciate about Everett's book, is he goes, it's one of the most plausible versions of the argument from Scale that I've encountered, and I've encountered a few of them, and I think this is one of the better and more articulate versions of it. Again, I was bothered a little bit about him dragging the Bible into it, but you know, whatever, if you want to take it that way, I'll roll with that.
I mean, I hate to keep going, but I mean, I guess that brings the point that you were talking about before, about having other holy texts, right? The reason to me it just seemed like this argument was not really feasible was because it did not seem generalizable.
I see.
It seems like it exists, like this argument exists because it was cherry-picking from one book.
Yeah, it seems to me that maybe that is a point of criticism of Everett's argument that I didn't consider. However, if he didn't appeal to a particular text in this case, then how is he going to get the sort of the meat to drive home the conclusion that humans are the only valuable thing through that implicit assumption of the argument? Yeah. So I think that's why he went to the text to try to get a motivation for that hidden premise.
My question really had to do with your use of this particular book and his argument against theism.
Mm-hmm.
That's one definition of God. You know,
yeah, and he actually says at the beginning of the book, there are other...
Dr. Tinsley asked you about your concept of God. You know, yours is a theistic concept of God.
Right.
So
that's why
that was my original question. You know, what is the definition of God?
Right, and we went over that, and that's just one of the reasons I find Everett's book compelling, because he sets out to critique the very conception of God, or something very close to it, that I happen to hold.
That's one kind.
Right, sure, it's one kind.
One kind of God.
Right, and look, if you eliminate one of the hypotheses from the field of theistic hypotheses, that's an interesting result. And if he successfully argues against the God of what we'll call the God of classical theism, the 3-0 God, omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent, and omnipresent, right? If you eliminate that hypothesis from the field of theistic hypotheses, that's an interesting result. And insofar as he sets out to eliminate or falsify that particular type of theistic hypothesis, I think that's a valuable enterprise. I don't think he succeeds, but fair enough. That my point that he doesn't succeed at eliminating that hypothesis with this particular argument still holds, even if some other conception of theism turns out to be correct, and my own conception of theism turns out to be wrong.
Okay. No more questions, I hope. Because we're just about out of time.
We can take one more.
Okay. The answer has to be short.
Okay, I'll try.
Okay. Well, it seems to me that the size of the universe is just one brick in a large edifice that renders implausible the idea that the world around us was created by an intelligent individual. It's not only cosmology that tells us the universe is 13.7 billion years old and it started in a very simple way and from it evolved without the intervention of any needed intelligent being to be the complexity we find today. But I mean, that's supported by geology, which tells us about the enormous age of the Earth and evolution and biology and the psychology and sociology that tell us that people invent stories like this about God for social purposes. So it's a rather narrow focus just to talk about the size of the universe as being evidence for or against God.
Fair enough. But if I addressed every chapter of his book, then my paper would be as long as, or nearly as long as the book itself. What I would say is the particular sorts of evidences that people often appeal to, maybe the appeal to the appearance of design in the world, or considerations of that sort that people often appeal to in favor of theism, aren't typically the kinds of arguments that I find motivating the theism that I hold. Again, the theism that I hold is largely motivated, again, by the ontological argument, also by the argument from the intelligibility of the observable universe, at least in part. And there are other arguments in addition to those that I would appeal to that aren't typically of the design variety that people normally hear. And in fact, the design argument, or the argument from the appearance of design, is the single most commonly advanced argument for theism, and it's just doesn't happen to be one of the ones that I advance. So even if I grant that all of your criticisms against that kind of argument are successful, it still doesn't speak to any of the motivating arguments that I have advancing my own theism.
Well, I don't know what's in your mind, so.
Well, that would be, again, that would be another paper, but I mentioned some of them in brief. So.